Bonjour et bienvenue sur le podcast White Ball The Bee. Je suis votre hôte, Sam Lange. Je suis accompagné de Sam Roberts et Sex Saméon. Nous parlons de France. Sam, why am I starting like that?
Please. I don't know. I don't know, Sam. Are you feeling all right? Yes, we're deep diving into France, as many people will have gathered from that wonderful introduction. James Harrington is with us. I'm terribly sorry, James. Can you pick up from there? Can you take us to where we need to go, please? Look, we've lost him already. Hello, James. How are you?
Hello. That was quite the introduction. Hello.
That was my GCSE.
Are you going to do all your questions in French? Are you going to do all in French? My goodness. Right. Go on. Hello, James. Welcome to the White Ball Rugby Podcast. As Sam said, we're delighted to have you with us. It should be really, really good. And you know, excited we are about all rugby that goes on. But French rugby at the moment must have a particularly strong heartbeat about it. I mean, what is the general feeling off the back of that incredible men's Olympics gold medal?
Everyone's getting very excited again. Obviously, it's not just the Olympic gold which has done remarkable things for Sevens. There's also the fact that the new season kicks off next Thursday, yeah, a week from today.
Wow.
It's just all it basically hasn't stopped since the summer before the Rugby World Cup, because they finished the top 14 season, went into the summer prep for the Rugby World Cup, did the Rugby World Cup, finished the top 14 season, and then went straight into the Olympics with obviously great success for Antoine Dupont and the men's sevens squad. And now it's all starting again. You'd expect some sort of fatigue by now, but it's genuinely not here. Everyone's building up for the next bit.
I was going to ask, what's the French for player welfare?
Rien.
I mean, that's extraordinary. Sam, I mean, that probably is something to kick us all off with. That, you know, is massive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, I believe it's Antoine Dupont played 35 15s games last season, mm-hmm. not including the sevens where he was off, you know, even before the Olympics, he was jet-setting around the world. That, I guess, has become a little bit of a punchline in the UK about French rugby, that it literally never stops and the pre-season starts before the season's finished. Is there a sense of that in France as well, James?
No. I mean, it's what the French are used to. The Pro D2 season ended in the beginning of June and they all returned at the beginning of July. The top 14 season, for most clubs, finished at the beginning of June. For Toulouse and Bordeaux, we got all the way to the final. It went on to the end of June, but they all then had a month off and resumed training mid to end of July. Bordeaux only went back, and Toulouse only went back a couple of weeks ago. So that the players have had a rest, and the squads are big enough to cope with the level of expectation that's placed upon them. Toulouse used, I think, 59 players last season.
Wow.
Including academy players. And there is not an expectation that you know, this is how it is. It's just everyone knows what they've got to do and they get on with it. And the teams are able to deal with the pressures put upon them. And you spoke about Antoine Dupont. Steve Blanc-Mapaz, who's gone to Lyon this year, played, I think, every single game for Grenoble. And,
okay.
And most of every single game for Grenoble.
Okay.
Dupont was quite often on the bench, and came off the bench for 20 minutes, half an hour when he came back. So his numbers were relatively small, although his game numbers were high. Steve Blanc-Lepaz, all the way through.
So how are they doing this then, James? I mean, because, you know, we joke about it, but, you know, players are only human, and mm-hmm. you know, this is a game which involves, and we are often told, you know, the equivalent of several car crashes a game. You know, their bodies are going through some pretty sizable elements of trauma, if you like, throughout the game. How are they not training? How are they doing this? How are the French doing this?
I dread to think what Steve Blanc-Lepaz does, in all honesty. Okay. I suspect he just sits down on the side all week and gets sort of trotted out on a Saturday. In all honesty, the physical prep is excellent. The medical care, the whole French medical care system is superb. And if you are injured, you are looked after from okay. start to finish. Even as an amateur, even as a, you know, just an ordinary person, if you get an injury doing a sport, you are looked after. My son plays rugby, and he got a sprained knee playing for in a training session, and he was sent to the hospital by the club, who phoned ahead. The doctor looked at him. The doctor knows his rugby, gave him a prescription for all the things he needed, and sent him for physio for like 8-9 weeks.
Right.
All covered. Didn't have to pay a thing. It's a proper sports physio, doing for a boy who's 14.
Okay. All right. So,
you know, he's looked after, and the players are genuinely well looked after. They're also worked very, very hard, and I think welfare could be improved further.
It's okay. An interesting situation, though, James, because as you mentioned, because from the outside, it can seem as though they're getting flogged quite hard. But I've known quite a few players who've played over in France, and you know, if you're based in the UK, it's quite possible to go and play in France, because you basically, in Pro D2 at least, you get a week off every month.
Yeah, five weeks on, 1 week off.
Yeah, and so it's a really kind of not too bad if you just want to do that for the season, if you've got family back in the UK. Do you think that's one of the reasons why France has become such an appealing prospect, beyond obviously the cash, which kind of dwarfs what the UK can offer?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, there's everything about it. There's the standard of living in France is ridiculously high. It's a wonderful part of the world to live in. I don't think anyone could argue with that. And even the painter is not necessarily high. Johnny May is apparently only on an average Pro D2 wage,
right?
Which is, according to Midi Olympique, around 60,000 a year, which isn't a huge amount of cash.
No,
it's not bad. Well, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't mind earning 60,000 a year, but that will be
less than what he was on at Gloucester. I'm pretty sure. Absolutely.
I'm almost certain about that. Now, there are a couple of tax things going on in the background that maybe mean his bottom line is not even better, but it's still, you know, it's not a great amount of money. But everything that comes with it, you know, living in, he's in the Charente, so he lives in this place that looks like the South Downs, only with real sunshine. And it's, or you go over to Grenoble, where Sam Davis is, and you've got the Alps on your doorstep, and you open the door and there's an Alp there. Or down in Provence, you've got everything about Provence down there for the likes of George North. So outside the rugby, there's kind of everything to live for.
It's interesting what you mentioned there. Sorry, James. It's interesting you mentioned there about the wages, because I remember hearing when Courtney Laws went that he was getting offered that Northampton would have to match four times his current salary. Whether that's accurate or not, I don't know, but you'd imagine that would be in the region of half a million to three quarters of a million, if that's right. But equally, there was something that came out, possibly from Midi Olympique, where they went through the whole Bielik squad and they listed their salaries. And they picked out a couple of key players and they showed how they were getting X amount as a base, plus they were getting two flights home a year to see their family, or the family were getting flown out. They were getting some help with housing, that kind of stuff. But again, it's not a package that is hugely more than the UK. So is there the big discrepancy between, you know, the likes of Laws, the likes of Dupont, who might be being offered pay that they could get nowhere else, and people who are a bit further down the funnel who may be getting pay that's comparative to the UK, but are getting all these other benefits as well?
It's I genuinely don't know. I mean, players, as you say, like Dupont are on very, very high salaries, and they're doing very nicely for themselves indeed. And of course, they're doing all the outside stuff as well, which makes it even better. But I understand there is a big drop off sometimes between the top payers and your journeymen fillers who come in and do a bit, or the ones who aren't as well known as your Dupont, your Entermax, and players like that. So, yeah. I mean, it's entirely possible, but at the end of the day, you're living in France, you're playing for Toulouse or Provence or Bayonne or Biarritz or whoever, and you know, you've got everything that goes on around that, as well as playing rugby for a living, which is
wonderful. you obviously realise that a lot of people listening to this will be England fans, and one of the big preoccupations with England fans is that French rugby works. English rugby doesn't work at the moment, and we can have a number of different examples to show you that English rugby at the moment isn't quite functioning like it should do. French rugby, theoretically, we were all green-eyed over in England, looking over the channel at you and going, why does theirs work? Why does it happen? Can you, for those listening in, can you try and define what it is that makes French rugby work, and bear in mind there may be people who know nothing about the game, so don't leave bits out, as it were, as far as the obvious things that myself and Sam might be aware of. What makes French rugby work?
I'm definitely not in a position to contrast with the UK rugby. I've not been to a match in the UK for 15 years, so I'm really not up to date with the whole match day experience in the Premiership or the URC, for example. But, I mean, it helps, as you say, the game is vibrant at all levels. There is a very much, at the lower levels and even higher up, there remains that parochial church in the middle of the village mentality where, you know, a federal two-game in Rigaud-Rien on a Sunday afternoon will attract high three-figure, low four-figure crowds. It just because it's the local club and everybody goes and everybody watches. And so that filters up to the bigger clubs, the Fédéral, National, Brodida, and obviously the top 14. But there's a big effort at all levels, and certainly at the pro level, to on marketing and promotion to make sure that the crowds continue. They're getting used to the changing demographic as well. I mean, according to recent data that the LNA released, the average season ticket holder is a middle-aged man. Mm-hmm. But they're really looking very hard at ways to bring in a younger, more female crowd to increase the market share of rugby. Again, it helps that Canal Plus have gone big on rugby to the detriment of football, so that it's on everywhere all the time on Canal, and they really push it hard from Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. There's matches four nights a week,
and is Canal available to everyone? Do you have to pay for Canal Plus?
It's pay TV.
Okay,
it's like Sky. But the back to the thing. There's everything from local initiatives. There's something as straightforward as training sessions moving away from the usual training ground to clubs in the catchment area or even schools. So Toulouse don't always train at Ernest Wallop. They will occasionally train out and about at a club ground, and it'll be an open training session. fans can go along and watch. They get to meet the players, they get to have a, and the staff, they get to have a bit of a chat, they have the photograph taken, and you know, you drag in crowds that way. And on the match day itself, there's a genuine proper connection between club and town that I don't necessarily think happens quite so much in the UK. On match day itself, I mean, matches, say you've got a match at 4:30 in the afternoon, gates will open at 1:30, 2:00, long before the players have arrived. The food trucks are there, the beer tents are open. You're there for, you know, to they make an absolute scene of the players arriving. You try and get anywhere near Stade Mayol when the players are arriving, and you've got a hope in hell. And after the match, the ground doesn't shut down.
Mm.
There's a bodega. Racing 92 open up. Racing 92 has to get rid of it. Open up the pitch and have a party on the pitch after the match. Toulouse do theirs just behind the press box, because I've been madly transcribing interviews to get it done before they actually kick off, so that because you can't hear what's going on once it starts. Cast have what they call a troisième mi-temps in a marquee directly opposite the ground, and it goes on till, and the players go, and it goes on till, you know, the match finishes at 6:30. It goes on till nearly midnight. Lyon have said, I read a report earlier this year that Lyon said they've got season ticket holders, young season ticket holders, who don't actually go to the match but go to the party afterwards.
Okay.
The money's still spent, you know, they still have the season ticket money in their bank account, it's still there, but they go for the party afterwards. And that's
it. I'd really encourage anyone to watch any level of French rugby, because I've been lucky enough. Last few years, I've probably watched more French rugby than I watched, English or Welsh rugby. I've watched Dijon, who were in Federal Un, I think, at the time. Carcassonne in Pro Deux, and Bourg-en-Bresse in National Un. That's the second, third, and fourth division, essentially. And obviously, the crowds were varied, and they weren't as massive in each place. But Bourg-en-Bresse, probably 3,500, which would dwarf Zebre, for example, in the URC, would be pushing what Dragons would get for the unattractive fixture. It was exactly as you described. Got in there early. There was stuff happening. In Dijon, it was a kind of an earlier game. And when we got there, there was a game beforehand, the Espoirs, like the youth or the second team game. It is a completely different experience to what can sometimes be a sanitized fan experience in the UK. I would say perhaps not necessarily at the Championship level, but at the Premiership level, it can be quite a sanitized experience. I mean, Sam, James, you know, you haven't been to a UK game for a while, but Sam, is that a fair assessment, do you think, of the UK game?
Yeah, it's getting better, you know, and I think, you know, the whole day event is bleeding more into, and you know, we had Tom Tainton on recently, and places like Bristol Bears are working out that is a great way to try and involve everyone that you possibly can. 100%, and Quins do a very good match day, Northampton Saints do a good match day. Bath is Bath. Leicester Tigers won't be too far behind. There are clubs that are a little bit more difficult to get a game going. And again, it comes back to the competition within that city. What else is going on in that city at that time? That's obviously very big. You mentioned it there, James, as regards the way that rugby sits against football in France. It is different, isn't it? And, you know, England has, five, six tiers of professional, properly all professional football. I mean, it's all professional, and that's a lot of clubs. That's a lot of clubs and a lot of areas, and you're up against a lot of different things. So, you know, it is tricky. I just feel that obviously, and I will be saying something that many listeners will have heard a lot before, we missed, England missed a trick right at the start of professionalism that France didn't, and France was able to very quickly sort out its league tiering system to allow it to have a through line, and with that came a huge amount else. I did want you to talk about something else, James, because again, I'm fascinated to shine lights on stuff. Can you talk about the what you would know as GIF, and can you talk about the process that France has as regards looking after players that are French? Because you know, a lot of people looking who might not have too much knowledge of French rugby might think that it's full of, you know, loads of Antipodean and South African and English players who have done their bit in their league and go there to get a pay packet. But talk about how the French have addressed that, can you, for those that might not know?
Okay. GIF, it's not French.
No? It's called SIF in front. No, it's not a joke. Terrible cleaning product joke. Dear. I'm sorry. Sorry. Carry on.
No. GIF is an attempt, it's proving quite successful, I think, to develop the strength of the French international squad of rugby in France. Now, because of European laws, they could not say French rugby for the French, because that restricts freedom of movement. So they fudged it a lot and said, okay, to qualify as a GIF player, you must have spent a certain amount of time playing either at an Ecole de Rugby in France with a French club, or with an academy set up at a French club before the age of 23. It's 5 years of Ecole de Rugby, which is the ASSO stuff below academy, before you get to academy, so under 16, under 18, that sort of thing. And academy is 18 to 23. So if you've gone through that, it doesn't matter what your nationality is. If you've done it in France, you are GIF. Ironically, Stefan and Dylan Armitage are GIF because they played their teenage rugby in Nice. While Jérôme Thion, who's as French as they come and a French international, would not have qualified because he didn't start playing rugby until quite late. Mm-hmm. Even Thierry Dussatoir was on the borderline, or would have been on the borderline when he played. And Jordan Joseph had to finish off his academy years at Racing, getting only occasional games because they had to maintain the GIF quota, and because he was another who started quite late, he wasn't GIF until he was 22.
Right.
So okay. he had to finish all that off. But anyway, once you've qualified as a GIF player, it makes it much easier to get a contract and get selected, because there are rules on the number of non-GIF players you can have in a wider squad. So a club like Toulouse, Castres-Olympique, Bayonne, whoever, or any of the Pro D2 sides, can only have 13 non-GIF players in their wider senior squad.
Now, I think that's different to England, because EQP obviously exists in England, Sam. Mm-hmm. I think it only applies to match day squads. I'm not 100% sure. Out of the 23, and James, you, and again, I'm happy to anyone listening on this who has the exactities on this, if we haven't got it right, correct us. But that's the wider squad. So effectively, you're going to have to fill your, which is crucial for young players, mm-hmm. you're going to have to fill the wider squad with French qualified players. Mm-hmm. Am I right? Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And on top of that, there is a match day requirement as well.
Okay.
Which is 14 players in a match day squad must be GIF.
Okay.
I think that's right. It's about 14 or 16.
Yeah.
And you've got to maintain an average of 16. If you don't maintain an average of 16, you will get points deducted the following season.
Okay.
If you hit 17, your average throughout the season, you have access to additional funding. So the onus is on clubs to develop players through their system. It doesn't as I said earlier, it doesn't matter what nationality they are, just that they've gone through the system and that they become GIF. Of course, after 5 years of playing rugby in France, they become eligible to play for France.
Yeah.
On residency grounds, which is entirely coincidental, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, let's not get ourselves into trouble here, but, you know.
Just one thing on that then, James, just on the specifics, and we could be getting into the minutiae here, but You mentioned there the average, maintaining the average. So theoretically, it's possible to do a kind of a Toulon, Matt Gitto, Johnny Wilkinson style thing and have more or less a full side of international players who are not GIF qualified, as long as at some other point in the season you play a side of exclusively young French lads.
Absolutely. Montpellier were Toulon season before last and Montpellier last season both cut it really close to the wire. Toulon were trying to get into the top six and missed that time. Montpellier were trying to avoid the drop and just about made it. But the coming into the last game, 2 weeks out, they were down, and they had to basically had to decide whether they pushed for survival and then starting this season on minus six, I think, or sort of just accepted that they were going to be in the playoffs in the access match playoff and get above the average. In the end, they decided that they would get above the average and play the access match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about the season ahead, James, because I'm fascinated now. Because I would love more eyes on French rugby, because as I say, I think it's honestly the best product we have out there. And we see it in the Champions Cup as well. You know, we see Toulouse come out and be the best team in Europe. But talk to us briefly. I'll fire some quick fire questions at you about top 14. So who is going to win the top 14?
I knew you were going to ask that.
Who shall I put my 20 pence on this year to win the top 14 games?
20 pence has gone up, Sam. Wow.
You've got to look very hard to get past Toulouse, frankly. They will have Antoine Dupont back from, word is, end of September.
That guy just can't catch a break, can he? He just has to keep on playing.
They played Montpellier, I think it was, last season, and he was on the bench, and he didn't get on. And the camera kept cutting to him throughout the match, and he was getting gradually more and more angry that he wasn't getting on. And he basically ate his own face at the end of it because he hadn't got on the pitch because Paul Grau, in his defence, had done a great job. And Toulouse won at Montpellier, but Antoine Dupont was not happy about not getting on. He just wants to play. That's all.
Beat Bordeaux very heavily at the final last season. That I think cut people a couple of different ways. So one way was Toulouse are just very special. The other was that they're so dominant that this is a slightly mismatched league.
This is what I was going to ask about. Is there a danger here though?
Yes, I think there is. But in counter to that, Bordeaux had a bad night at the office. They had a difficult run in. Jalibert was injured. Tammy Funa was injured. They risked them both. Was it the right decision? I think it possibly was. But you know, Jalibert admitted that he felt his hamstring that had been troubling him. Felt his hamstring twinge in the 15th minute, and after that, he was trying to nurse his way through. He got to 55. But it was never quite right. Bordeaux are a good side. How they do this season will be quite interesting because it's the first time they'd got to a final, and it's they've only just resumed after that. So they've got a really short pre-season, and then if the season gets underway, and more than one club have come a cropper the season after they've reached the final. La Rochelle, another strong side. Clermont are coming back. Toulon are coming back. There's four or five who could push and on their day beat Toulouse, but Toulouse are very, very, very good.
There's going to be some interest in Pro de Deux as well. Pro de Deux, owning now for the season the players that potentially are pretty eye catching, like George North and Courtney Laws going into that French second division. Has that, in terms of attraction to Pro de Deux, has that lit the French imagination as much as it would do potentially, English and Wales fans looking at it?
I think the French say are looking over at the English and going, what you've only just noticed. It's because. Sam knows, and the Pro de Deux is a really, really special league. It's insane sometimes. It's absolutely crazy. But the whole system, the whole promotional relegation thing, I don't particularly want to get into that, but that really works. The fact that the Pro De Deux clubs have a seat at the LNR table and have a say. Yes, there's, you know, 30 club presidents all having an argument quite regularly, but it means that the Pro De Deux isn't ignored, like the champion, like Premiership clubs, I think, can kind of ignore the Championship clubs, who back sort of hammering at the door, trying to get in, and the Premiership saying, I don't know.
Accurate representation.
but you know, the Pro De Deux clubs have a say. They have, you know, they some of the top 14 money goes to TV money goes to the Pro De Deux, and the next TV deal that doesn't actually kick in till 2027, absolutely huge thing, it's just shy of 700 million over 4 years, is top 14 and Pro De Deux combined. So the whole thing is built on a 30 club foundation rather than a smaller 12 or now 10 club foundation, which is that bit stronger. And there are financial rules as well that have to be maintained. They have to, I think they've got to have 15% of their salary cap in a slush fund just in case.
Yeah, which is not something I don't believe is something that we have in the UK, at least. You mentioned the Pro De Deux there. We got a question. We farmed out for some questions for you. Got one from Gaston Kelly. So Van have moved up this season. He asked, what can we expect from Van this season? They've been very good for a couple of years, James, and they've gone on a spending spree this off season. So what do you
they have? They take advantage. They have a GIF leniency this for 2 years. This year, normally you're allowed 13 non-GIF players in your wider squad. They're allowed 15 this year and 14 next year, and then drop down to 13.
What? Why? Sorry, excuse my ignorance.
So, because of the way the league is set up, they can't really enter the transfer market until quite late.
Right. So
So they sometimes have to look a little further afield to get players. This time they really didn't. So they can sort of get experience and quality players in to cope with the difficulty of the top 14. I mean, I'm mostly looking forward just to going to Brittany for a game of rugby, frankly, you know, the Stade de Rabine. I've never been, but it's got a truly astonishing entrance that I think will just set. You know, Kenilworth Road.
I didn't think we'd get this segue. Carry on.
you know, you go through that gate. Oak Road, is it? You go through the gate and the terraced houses.
Yeah.
It's like that, only French.
Okay, right.
So it's, rather than terraced houses, you've got an 18th century building.
Yeah.
With a chapel on one side, a conservatoire on the other, and a convent at the back.
Okay.
With respect,
this is not looking anything like Kenilworth Road at the moment. I'm kind of with you.
it's the principle of the thing.
Yes, yeah, I get you.
The entrance
in amongst it, you mean there's lots going on around the ground, and it feels as though it's very much stuck in the middle of stuff. Yes,
yeah, very much so. Now, as I really hope that the club can live up to the fans' dreams. I mean, the fans believe, they genuinely believe. They crashed the website this summer when season tickets went on sale. They had a town of 54,000. They had 50,000 people waiting, trying to get a season ticket.
Wow.
The club had to halt season ticket sales at 9,000 so they can sell some on match day. Bear in mind that Stade de l'Arabine at the moment is about 13,000.
So it's going to be jumping every game.
It's going to be jumping absolutely every game. It's going to be like La Rochelle or La Rochelle or Bayonne. It's going to be absolutely jumping all the time. They do genuinely have reason to believe, because 20 years ago they were in Fed Dirt. That's when the head coach of Geico John North Spitzer took charge for the first time. He retired as a player, went to head coach, got them promoted in his first season to the Fed. And in 2017, they got to the Pro De Deux. Now they're in the top 14. There's been a progression plan all the way to do this. It's all been part of a wider plan to bring top flight rugby to Van and Northwest Van. It's steady, it's calm, it's thought out. The next step is clearly consolidation and expansion. They're talking about the expanding Stade de la Rabine to its 15,000-18,000, but they're going to take their time over it. You know, their first job is to survive, and everything follows from there. If they don't survive this time, they'll give it a go and have another go next season from the Pro Dida.
Whenever I speak to anyone about French rugby, Sam Lana, I always get this overriding sense of it makes logical sense. Everything they do, even when James said about the fact that obviously they have a bit of a GIF leniency and they explained it, you're like, yeah, well, that makes sense. And it's sort of logic that sometimes is missing from our version of the game sometimes. And that's what makes me envious, I suppose, is that there is reasoned thought and thinking that goes into it. And maybe that's because of, you know, you mentioned it earlier, James, about frameworks and structure. Even from the healthcare point of view, everything just seems to be well built, well sorted out. Everyone seems to be operating within an area that seems to be well housing the whole process really, really well. So that's, I mean, absolutely brilliant to talk to you, James. Always, always good to learn more about the French. The French game. I will be personally looking out for Van then, definitely. I won't be able to get a ticket, that's for sure. I will be looking out for them. It's been really insightful again, hasn't it, Sam Lana?
It really has. And yeah, I mean, please, whoever's listening to this, go to France and watch a game. It doesn't matter what league you go to, really. I mean, some of the most fun I've had rugby game is at, you know, Dijon, who are third division, so it's really enjoyable. Definitely get out there then. James, just as we leave, give us your pick for Pro Dida. What one team who was going to get a promotion this season?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I think Brive will do it over Provence.
Interesting. Okay. We did have a question about whether Brive were going to be the new La Rochelle, so that's set. Definitely might be. But James,
and
really,
and that's 40p. That's 40p you now have to spend, Sam. That's a lot of money.
Big money coming back to me, though.
I'll do your stake back if you lose.
Oh, fantastic. Very good. Thank you very much indeed, James Harrington. Thank you very much, Sam Lana. It's been another wonderful episode of the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast.